The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
So, I'm going to do one commentary. I have several commentaries I didn't have a chance to get to yet. I'll get to some in the next hour. The killing fields of multinational corporations on pesticides, pollution, and the economies of genocide by Vandana Shiva, who we're filming in India in 2 weeks. The Great Pacific Garbage Patch is bigger than the continental U.S., and every American that drinks and disposes in the improper way of a bottle goes into that patch, and it's, I'll tell you how much it's killing away of sea life. Are veterans being given deadly cocktails to treat post-traumatic stress disorder? Yes, they are, by Martha Rosenberg of Alternet. And then a great discussion we're going to have on AIDS in a moment. But before we go there, this is an important commentary. For those of you who believe that anyone who talks about the conspiracies within our government is all nonsense or paranoia, think again. This is from H.P. Albrelli and Zoe Martell in Truth Out. News analysis. Florida dengue fever outbreak leads back to the CIA and Army experiments. This is worth listening to. With little fanfare, on July 13th, Florida officials released the findings of a Center for Disease Control study conducted recently in the Key West area, revealing that about 10%, or 1,000 people, of the coastal town's population are infected with dengue fever virus. 10% of an entire area in Key West. And while the July 13th release made little mention of it, the CDC study was provoked by an earlier study, that of a woman in New York State who had returned from the Florida Keys visit, had contracted dengue fever. Within a few weeks of this initial report, two additional cases were discovered and people had returned from Key West. Over the next 3 months, an additional 26 cases identified, all tied to visits to the town. Now, because of these reported cases, the Florida Keys Mosquito Control District conducted greatly increased aerial spraying to control mosquitoes. Following the spraying, a small amount of other cases were reported, including that of a 41-year-old Key West man who found blood in his urine and had severely aching joints. Following these additional reports, CDC launched a study of antibodies in Key West residents and found that a high level of the town's residents had been exposed to the dengue virus. Said CDC expert on dengue, Dr. Christopher Gregory, quote, the best estimate from the survey is that about 5% of residents were infected in 2009 with dengue. We have known for a while it is a possible risk, but this outlook shows that it is more than possible. It is something that did happen and could happen again, unquote. Now, here's where it gets interesting. Despite the low-key nature of the Florida release, the Homeland Security Administration immediately issued a terror alert concerning the findings of Monroe County, within which Key West is isolated, and also issued its own health advisory warning, effective immediately. Now, dengue fever is a virus-based disease spread by bites of the mosquito. It can be caused by any one of four separate but related viruses carried by infected mosquitoes. Most commonly, the mosquito in that area found in tropic and subtropic areas, and is commonly found in Southeast Asia and South and Central America, Indonesia and Sub-Saharan Africa. Over the past decades, it has been consistently reported that dengue fever has been eradicated, zero in the United States. So dengue hemorrhagic fever is a far more severe form of the dengue virus. If untreated, it will kill you. You will die. And the chief symptoms of dengue fever are high fever, severe headache, strong pain behind the eyes, joints, muscles, bone pain, easy bruising, rash, and mild bleeding from the nose and gums. There is no cure, there is no vaccine for dengue fever. One can only treat the symptoms in such a way as to getting plenty of rest, drink lots of liquids, take pain relievers, and you better have a skilled physician overseeing you. It appears highly unlikely that any detective work performed by the CDC or Florida health officials will unearth evidence of dengue fever being imported into Florida. But that evidence certainly exists. Prior to the recent Key West findings and still today, the CDC has consistently reported there has been zero outbreaks of dengue fever in Florida since 1934 and none in the continental United States since 1946. They are liars. Listen up, people. unknown to most Americans is that dengue fever has been the intense focus of U.S. Army and CIA biological warfare researchers for the past 50 years. Ed Regis notes in his excellent work, A Fort Detrick, The Biology of Doom, that as early as 1942, leading biochemists at the installation placed dengue fever on a long list of serious considerations as biological weapons. In the early 1950s, Fort Detrick, in partnership with the CIA, launched a multi-million dollar research program under which dengue fever and several additional exotic diseases were studied for use in offensive biological warfare attacks. Assumably, because the virus is generally not lethal, program planners viewed it primarily as an incapacitant. Read one CIA Project Artichoke documents, quote, "Not all viruses have to be lethal. The objective includes those that act as short-term and long-term incapacitants," unquote. Several CIA documents, as well as the findings of a 1975 congressional committee, reveal that three sites in Florida, Key West, Panama City, and Avon Park, as well as two other locations in central Florida, were used for experiments with mosquito-borne dengue fever and other biological instances. The experiments in Avon Park, 170 miles from Miami, were covertly conducted in low-income African-American neighborhoods that contained several newly constructed public housing projects. CIA documents related to its top-secret project MK-Naomi clearly indicate that the mosquitoes used in Avon Park were the type, the Agapiti type, specifically equipped aircraft. In one of the larger experiments, released 600,000 mosquitoes over the area. In one of the Avon Park experiments, about 150,000 mosquitoes were dropped in paper bags designed to open upon contact. Each bag held 1,000 insects. Besides dengue, some of the mosquitoes were also carrying yellow fever. Avon Park residents still living in the area say experiments resulted in many deaths. One elderly resident told Truthout, quote, "Nobody knew about what had gone on here for years, maybe over 20 years, but in looking back, it explained why a bunch of healthy people got sick quick and died at the time of those experiments," unquote. Interesting, at the same time, experiments were conducted in Florida. There were at least two cases of dengue fever reported among civilian researchers at Fort Detrick in Maryland. In 1978, Pentagon publication entitled Biological Warfare, Secret Testing and Volunteers, unquote, reveals that the Army's Chemical Corps and Special Operations and Projects Divisions at Fort Detrick conducted, quote, tests similar to the Avon Park experiment in Key West. But the bulk of the documentation concerning this highly classified and covert work is still held by the Pentagon as secret. One former Fort Detrick researcher says the Army, quote, performed a number of experiments in the area of the Keys, but that, quote, not all concerned dengue virus. In 1959, Fort Detrick launched its largest mosquito experiment called Operation Bellwether, consisting of over 50 separate field experiments. Some of these experiments, designed to ascertain the rate of biting and mosquito aggressiveness, were conducted in partnership with scientists with the Rockefeller Institute, New York, where scientists bred their own strain of mosquitoes. Some of the bellwether experiments were conducted in Florida, but others were conducted in Georgia, Maryland, Utah, and Arizona. A 1978 Pentagon publication, along with two other Chemical Corps reports, revealed the identities of the number of companies and institutions that assist the Army in its offensive biological warfare experiments. Armor Research Foundation, the Battelle Memorial Institute, Venue Labs, Inc., University of Florida, Florida State University, and Lovell Chemical Company. In the spring and summer of 1981, Cuba experienced a severe hemorrhagic dengue fever epidemic. Between May and October, the island had 158 dengue-related deaths, and about 75,000 people were infected. Prior to this outbreak, Cuba had reported only a small number of cases, and that was back in 1944. At the height of the epidemic, over 10,000 people per day were found infected, and 116,000 were hospitalized. At the same time as the outbreak, covert biological warfare attacks on Cuba's residents and crops were believed to have been conducted against the island by CIA contractors, there's your contractors, and military airplane flyovers. Now those would be private contractors. Particularly harmful to the nation was a severe outbreak of swine flu that Fidel Castro attributed to the CIA. American researcher William Schapp, an editor of Covert Action magazine, claims that Cuba's dengue outbreak was the result of CIA activities. Former Fort Detrick researchers, all of whom refused to have their names used for this article, say they performed, quote, advanced work on the Cuba outbreak and that it was man-made. The Soviet media reported the CIA sent operatives into Afghanistan from Pakistan to launch dengue epidemic. The Soviets claimed the operatives were posing as malaria workers, but instead were releasing dengue-infected mosquitoes. The authorities in Nicaragua accused the CIA of creating a massive outbreak of dengue fever that infected thousands in that country. That's when we were at war in where the Russians were in Afghanistan. We wanted them out, and also in the Nicaragua Sandinista War. That's when they went in there. CIA officials, of course, always deny everything, but the researchers claim that huge colonies of mosquitoes infected with not only dengue fever but also yellow fever were maintained at Fort Detrick, Maryland installation, as well as hordes of flies carrying cholera and anthrax, and thousands of ticks fell with Colorado fever and relapsing fever. A review of declassified Army Chemical Corps documents revealed that the Army may have also been engaged in dengue fever research as early as the late 1940s. And dengue fever and the British Petroleum spill complications. The timing of this outbreak of dengue fever presents two additional problems. The symptoms of dengue fever are very similar to that of exposures to chemicals such as those contained in crude oil and the dispersants currently being used in the contaminated areas of the Gulf of Mexico, potentially making it difficult to diagnose the source of a sufferer's symptoms. Worse yet, there looms the possibility that Corexit and other toxins present in the Gulf area may weaken the immune system, thus setting the stage for more severe forms of the disease in people who are or have previously been exposed to the virus. It is still unclear to what degree residents of the Gulf area at large have been or will be exposed to such chemicals in the long term, but there is mounting evidence that fishermen, cleanup workers, and others who spend significant times in contact with the Gulf waters are beginning to display symptoms consistent with chemically induced neurotoxicity. If dengue fever also spreads within the Gulf community, affecting a significant number of people, it will be increasingly difficult to differentiate the cause of symptoms in those who develop them, even in persons who test positive for dengue exposure. The additional possibility remains that chemical toxicity is present as well. The presentation of dengue fever varies considerably from case to case. So that's just some of this, and it goes on for 20 pages. Now, could you imagine dengue fever now, there, with symptoms that are could be used to cover up? Do you see the point I'm making?
Sure.
So what if British Petroleum had its interest being protected by the CIA and these secret agencies, and someone comes up with the idea, if we put dengue fever in the Keys and then in other areas, and someone ends up being exposed to the chemicals, they won't be able to tell that it's the chemical that's causing the problem. They'll think it's dengue fever.
Right.
Suddenly there's 1,000 people with dengue fever.
Out of nowhere.
Wow. Out of nowhere?
Yeah.
Oh. But do you see this anywhere in the American media?
No.
That the United States government and its private contractors are running a fascist operation that could be covering British Petroleum's tracks, the same government and the same private contractors that are causing people to be arrested if they want the truth. A scientist cannot go out into the Gulf. A reporter cannot go out and get the information they want.
But you don't see this being covered in international press either, which we have a lot of enemies out there that would think we're grappling this. Maybe there's the conspiracy beyond, goes beyond just our borders.
Well, it could be, but no one knows the story. That's why I reported on it.
I see.
All right? And it's all documented. That's why people listen, all right? Because we're going to cover things that no one else is. One last thing before we go to our next program, and our guests are standing by. This is about the environment, and I believe each and every one of us can do a lot. By the way, next week on my Monday show, when we release the new article and the new video,
yes,
I've come up with an idea of how to help the vets. There are 800,000 homeless vets each year in the United States. And this video that you now see up on Progressive Radio Network, and read the article that goes with it, fully documenting it, there are 16,000 of those vets in Central Florida. I'm going to launch within the next month. I also have to go down where we're doing, you know, our project in Haiti, and that too, probably do at the same time. But I'm going to try to get the cooperation of one of the communities in Central Florida, and to take a small piece of land. I only need an acre, 1 acre. If nothing else, I'll just buy it. And to set up a tent city for homeless vets, where there would be a services from psychologists, medical for in case they're suffering from serious post-traumatic stress disorders or a Gulf War syndrome related, food, they'd have a cafeteria, and then quarters where the women would have quarters, men would have quarters, and showers, and a recreation. So at least they're not sleeping on the streets.
Exactly.
And there would be people there to help them, get off drugs, which many of them are on, alcohol, which most of them are on, try to help them get work papers and get them gainfully employed.
To make a community.
To start with a small community, and then to have a place where their spouses and children could come and visit with them, because a lot of them have lost their families because their emotions were still in combat mode when they went home. They had not been deprogrammed, so they didn't know how to relate to simple issues, you know, in their home. So this would be a way for them to reconnect, and so people could see that they were not on a street, they were not drinking, they were not on drugs, and they would be around other people. There would only be Gulf War vets there, people they have something to share, you know, a common spirit with. So that's my goal, is to set this up and get it running for, 100 vets, and then to film it and use that as a model. And then if that model works, then we could put that in every 50 states. But we don't want the government touching it, because the government can't do a damn thing right. Everything it touches, it screws up.
Everything.
Because first it's going to privatize it, and then you're going to have crap, it's going to be militarized.
It'll be sponsored.
And then you'd have McDonald's tent. We need to do this. Americans need to do this for Americans. And the American government is not an American government. It's a fascist government. And it's lost its way. We no longer can call ourselves a democracy. Now, if you challenge that, and I hope you do, then let's just look at the reality. Can you get elected to President of the United States tomorrow?
No.
No. But what if a corporation, let's say we had three corporations, let's say we had Goldman Sachs, and we had Exxon, and we also had Microsoft, got together and said, Carolee, we want you to sponsor these forms of change, take away these rules, impediments, give us these tax breaks, and we're going to put you in office because together we're going to donate $500 million. We're going to buy you an election because everyone knows you buy elections. Then that's what the U.S. Supreme Court allowed to happen, where corporations are given the same rights as individuals so they can sponsor people without any limitation. That's not a democracy. That is a terrible, terrible form of... It's more than totalitarian. It is elitism at its worst. And then that leads to the evisceration of anything that represents a republic or democratic governance. So we don't have what we ideally should, and we don't have what we think we have. And the people who are in power in corporations and in the government are not serving the people's needs. They're serving their own and special interest needs. And we see it in everything they do. Their fingerprints are all over it. And they're so brazen about it today, because it's not illegal, that they actually mock the process. When the President of the United States meets with the Business Roundtable, a completely contemptible group of individuals who tell him what they want, and then he sends his little lapdog, Ron Emanuel, out to do it. And That's how it works. There are no progressives in that White House at all or administration at all. And the ones in the media are either been expelled from mainstream media and only exist in the periphery. What they don't control yet is the internet. And that's where we have a chance to make our voices heard. And I'm glad that the mainstream media is dying. Because it's like watching a coward, the betrayed, its people die. Let it die. Hope it comes back in the next world as a lawyer. Right? Judith Miller, the New York Times, all these reporters, they don't represent true journalism anymore. And we need the journalism of progressive minds, and that's on the internet. Right now, 42% of the American population consider themselves independent and progressive. That's double Democrats and more than doubles Republicans. So we're just not organized. We haven't brought our different minds together to focus upon what we can do in a constructive way. A lot of good people. That will happen, but not during this election cycle. It will not happen until the next cycle. It has to get worse, and it will, before these minds come together. And when they do, about 3 years from now, 4 years from now, when Hillary Clinton is president, and she will be the next president, Sarah Palin will run against her. But Clinton will just dance all over her. All right? And again, look at all the private contractors that they have. They can get anything on anyone they can. And Clintons are notorious for finding dirt about people and using it. Boy, someone ought to take a careful look in the mirror before they go getting dirt on other people.
Exactly.
But that's the world we live in. Power mongers, megalomaniacs run amok. Anyone who thinks otherwise, take a look. So here's where we go on this, the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. This is from Jamie Heimbach of Planet Green. Quote, researchers and activists are constantly working on learning more about the extent of the Pacific Garbage Patch and finding ways to clean up the damage. And we're constantly keeping you updated on what their efforts are. And check out this. What is the Pacific Garbage Patch? Simply put, it's a swirling mass of plastic in the middle of the Pacific Ocean that is big enough to qualify as the planet's largest landfill, roughly located in an area in the middle of the Pacific. Much of the world's trash is accumulated into this part of the Pacific Ocean based upon the movement of ocean currents. Well, it's been called the trash vortex or the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. How does all this plastic get to the ocean? Simple answer, humans plus ocean currents equals trash vortex. People create and consume and carelessly toss plastic and litter, and it ends up in the waterways. As the plastic reaches the shoreline, currents carry it out into the ocean, and a convergence of currents swirl the plastic into one general area. No one is guiltless when it comes to the Pacific Garbage Patch. If you consume and discard goods, you are responsible for some portion of the plastic that is ending up in the ocean, even if you live hundreds of miles from the seaside. All rivers lead to the sea, and trash that ends up in a stream in the middle of the U.S. can end up in the ocean, and with the help of ocean currents, finds itself in the middle of a trash vortex. Now, what's the impact of marine litter on wildlife? The plastics found in the ocean have a dire effect on marine life. Turtles confuse plastic bags for jellyfish, and birds confuse bottle caps for food. They ingest them but can't digest them, so their stomachs fill with plastic and they starve to death, even though they continue to try to eat. Additionally, fish on the low end of the food chain consume tiny bits of plastic, and they're in turn eaten by larger fish, which catch and eat, and are eaten by humans. So we're now quite literally eating the plastic we produce. Not an appetizing thought. How much plastic is in the Pacific Garbage Pass? We have no idea. We have estimates on the size of the pass, at least in terms of surface area. Research peg the trash vortex to be as large as the continental United States. And according to HowStuffWorks.com, every square mile of ocean hosts 46,000 pieces of floating plastic, and plastic constitutes 90% of all trash floating in the world's oceans. But exactly how many pieces of plastic is impossible to say, and researchers are still stunned at how much they find when they get out there to assess the damage we're doing in one of our most precious resources. What's worse, the Pacific Garbage Patch is not the only trash vortex out there. There are five of these trash vortexes. Located in the Pacific, Atlantic, Indian Oceans, the trash vortexes represent what we're doing to our planet on a global scale. Everything from fish nets to bottle caps, from the tiny pellets of plastic that are in your exfoliated face soap to old toys, are all ending up floating in the sea. And it's a mess. Now, what can we do to clean it up? Nothing. There's no process we have that will clean it up. It's one of those things that have tipped. What can we do to prevent it from getting worse? That we can do. Here's what we can do. First, you can volunteer for beach or river cleanup efforts. You can put trash in a secure, lidded receptacle. Most marine debris starts out on land. Properly recycle everything you can in your area. When boating, bring your trash bag to shore and ask your marina to handle waste properly. And less is more. Don't buy stuff you don't need, and choose items that use less packaging. Inform and inspire your friends and co-workers to help stop marine debris at the source. Bring your own containers for picnics instead of using disposables. Take your own reusable bags wherever you go shopping. And write to companies or visit local businesses and encourage them to reuse, recycle, and generate less packaging. And tell Congress it's time to stop trash in our ocean. That's not going to do any good, because Congress is trash.
Trash.
All right. I'm Gary Nall. Any final comments before we go to our last segment of our program with our guest?
What are we going to do to go to 600% increase?
As you know, we don't do any advertising.
Right.
No billboards, no magazine ads, no cross radio promotions on other stations. As long as I've been on radio and television, it's all just word of mouth. I believe that if you're telling people what they want to hear and need to know, that the people will come to you. And there should be an effortless synchronicity between the two. I remember it goes back to 1976 on WMCA, and I was invited on because my friend Bob Smith, who had been the president and CEO of WOR Radio and Television, AM and FM, spoke with Ellen Strauss. Now, the Strauss family was very powerful in politics. Her husband was major Democratic spokesperson, and they owned WMCA Radio, a 5,000-watt station. But they had some heavyweight hitters on there: Sally Jesse Raphael, Barry Gray, Bob Grant, Long John Neville, Bruce Powers, Bruce Williams, and did I mention Barry Farver? So they didn't have any place for me except one spot in the afternoon, 2 o'clock, called the dead time. And when I went on, the ratings were about 1,600 listeners for the whole hour. And the others in the morning, like Sally Jesse, who had her television show at the time, and Larry King. Oh, Larry King was on there live, too. That's before he was on CNN. He had somewhere in the neighborhood of, I think, about 20,000. Sally Jesse had around 35,000. These were big numbers then. And the only other person who was bigger was John Gamling on WOR. And they had been there forever, and the McCanns. And by the way, I see Patricia McCann all the time. She shops my health food store. Wonderful woman. I keep asking her, come back on the air. We need you. In any case, so I started off. And after about a week, I'm called into Ellen Strauss's office. And she was like a fire-breathing tiger lady. She said, she's not looking at me. She's just pounding this pencil on the table. And she said, how long do you think you're going to be on radio? And I said, I don't know. She says, well, you're not going to be on here very long if you don't start doing radio the way it should be. I want you to listen to Carlton Fredericks on WR. That's who I want you to be. You're going to be Carlton Fredericks. We want his audience. You're just the younger version of him. So I turned on Carlton Fredericks, and everything was the same. Every show was the same. And so he was giving a lecture, so I went to see his lecture. He had a big audience, all white hairs. No young people in his audience. And he was up on stage smoking and talking. And his idea was eat meat, but eat organic meat. That was the whole thing. And that and hypoglycemia and high-protein diet. And he was also drinking coffee with sugar in it, eating meat. And afterwards, someone introduced us, and he comes over to me, and he points his finger in my chest and says, "I heard about you. You're that young guy. So you want to be like me?" And I looked at him and I said, "No, sir, I don't." And he just laughed and he walked away. And that was one of those moments where you have to make a choice. So I spoke to Bob and I said, "Bob," I said, "I'm stuck at this level now. They want me to be like someone else because he's popular. He's the only voice on health in the United States on radio. And on the biggest station in the United States. WR at that time was the biggest station in the United States. But he is not a person that advocates health, in my opinion. In fact, there's no one in the United States in the health movement that advocates health. Adele Davis, Gaylord Houser, Bob, Leelor Cardell, Bob Hoffman. None of these people are healthy. I saw them all at a convention this past weekend. They were all smoking and drinking, eating meat. They were all out of shape. They don't believe in any things I believe in. So I either have to go in there and tell Alan Strauss, I'm sorry, but, you know, I'm going to, rather than disappoint you and embarrass myself, I'll just make my exit. He said, if you do that, you won't be able to find a place anywhere else. And I said, well, then I have to do the next thing I can do. Just go in there and be who I am and let her fire me. Was it turns out she went on vacation. And so she was on vacation, and I just started doing what I thought was important. Talk about the issues that people want to hear about. Positive, healthy things. And that's all I did. I wouldn't take any calls from people about their disease. I said, if you have a question that allows you to be healthier, I'll answer it. But I don't want Carlton Fredericks' audience. That's his audience. That's his area. That's his expertise. That's a perfect match. I'm Gary Nall. And I'm not going to be him. And I said this on the air. And then she comes back, and she'd been away for a month. And I remember that I'll never forget this meeting. There, all of us are sitting around on a Wednesday morning in the conference room, and she says, "Well," she said, "we have someone here who thinks that that Bob Grant should be back on the air." Now, I have a question. Is that true, Barry? And she was saying, Barry Farber. He says, yes, I believe that he should be on the air. I don't believe he should be taken off because of censorship. She says, well, Barry, gee whiz, I agree with you. I think he should. But there's a problem. There's no room for him. So Barry Farber, should he take Sally Jesse's place? Barry said, no. Well, then maybe Barry Gray's place. No, then Long John went around the room. Whose place should he take? And Barry said, well, let him take my place. Now, that showed me that Barry Farber had more character, more decency, more ethic, and more courage than any human being I've ever met in my career on television or radio. He was not just an intellectual giant. He was one of the most unique human beings I've ever met, and still is. And afterwards, I went over to him and I said, Barry, I don't know Bob Grant, but is he the short guy? Yeah, well, he's been coming in here on Saturdays meeting with Alan Strauss. So they'd already been planning this. So I saw Bob Grant at the elevator, and I read him the Riot Act. Oh, I read him the Riot Act, man. Man, I was hoping he'd open his mouth to me. Oh, there would have been a tussle right there. There would have been no competition, but there would have been I would have got my ass fired in a heartbeat. So anyhow, I just saw what kind of woman she was, what kind of manipulator she was. Then I defended Barry. I stood up and I defended him at the meeting, and I said, I'm ashamed of you all at this room. You're allowing this woman, every time she comes in, to say something negative, to put you down. And the only one who stood up to her is Barry Farber. And I said, Barry Gray, I thought you had more courage than that. I didn't know that Barry had gotten hit with a payola thing, and she had dropped his salary down to almost nothing. I didn't know that at the time. Anyhow, I didn't like him anyhow. So I was told later that day by the program director, gee, Gary, shouldn't have done that. your history. But then something happened. The Arbitrons came in, and I went from like 1,600 to 60,000.
60?
60, 6-0. I had the highest ratings on the whole station. So now they were between a rock and a hard place. So instead of firing me, they gave me an extra hour daily and 4 hours Saturday, but didn't increase my salary. Then after came in and said, you have to give more money. So she gave me the minimum amount possible. My ratings just kept going up and up and up and up and up until I had the highest ratings of anyone in America in my time slot. And I was second only behind John Gambling. And it was all word of mouth. In the end, she did something that was purely Machiavellian. I did a 4-hour special a year later, a year and a half later, to honor Carlton Fredericks. I had on all the top people in the world of health and nutrition. It was a 4-hour special. But he didn't come on. When I came off the air, Mark Mason called me in his office, program director, and he says, Gary, that was quite simply one of the best programs I've ever heard on radio. But you're fired. I said, why am I fired? Because Carlton Fredericks has taken your place. Carlton Fredericks, the guy I just did a 4-hour special on?
Right.
Yeah. He's been meeting with Ellen Strauss, and he's going to take your audience and your sponsors and keep his audience and sponsors, so she thinks. And I said, Mark, I said, you're a smart guy. Do you really think that that anyone's going to go from our WOR 50,000 watts that never fires anyone, that has people there even if they're dead? I think they stick them up at a mic and they allow them to continue. Arlene Francis, all these people have been there forever, to the most radically unstable station in New York that has a history of firing everyone on a whim, that's run by this woman. I don't believe it either, Gary, but that's the word. So I met Barry Gray in the hallway. I said, Barry, I've been let go. I won't be able to come back on. Could you just let my audience know that if I give you a mailing address, a post office? Yeah, sure, I'll be happy to. Then I'm driving uptown. I'd ask a buddy, Philip J. Hodes, to load up my stuff when we were going up. And here on the radio, there's Barry Gray saying, oh, and Carlton Fredericks is coming in to take Gary's place because Gary's gone on to do a syndicated show. And so Carlton Fredericks said he wanted to honor Gary's audience, so he's coming over. All right, so fine. Carlton Fredericks didn't tell anyone at OR he was leaving. So I immediately get a call from Bob Bruno saying, Gary, why don't you come in here and talk about taking Carlton Fredericks' place? Yeah. This is a story people in radio don't know. So that was on Friday. Monday morning, Carlton Fredericks supposed to start at my place, but he doesn't show up. So there's Barry Gray saying, well, he should be here any moment. He should be here any moment. He never showed up. So then they panic. And guess what? That night, Carlton Fredericks continued doing his show, saying, there must be some misunderstanding. You know, I'm here for good. Carlton Fredericks set this whole thing up to get rid of me, his competition. Here's what Carlton Fredericks didn't know. 6 months before then, a man who ran his syndication, he was on 115 stations, called me and says, let's have dinner. So we had dinner, and he said, look, here's the offer. I'm willing to give you X amount of money. Take over Carlton Fredericks' show and syndication. He's losing stations. He doesn't do his homework. Same show. It's not interesting. We need a younger audience. And I thought about it, and I said, I can't do that. He said, what do you mean? I said, I can't take someone's show. I'll earn my own show, but in my view, I can't win at someone else's loss. Spiritually, I can't do that. He said, well, that's just stupid. I said, well, you're probably right from your point of view, but for me, I want to sleep tonight. And I want to know that anything, any position I get in life is because I earned it, not because I threw someone overboard to get it. That's not how I work. And he immediately turned and got Robert Atkins, who would sell his soul, right? And did, and hurt a lot of people. A lot of people got sick and died because of Atkins' diet, and I knew Bob very well. In any case, he never knew that I saved his... I didn't take his job. He later lost it. And then guess who Fredericks went to work for? Robert Atkins. Yeah, this is the world we live in. In any case, then when Fredericks ended up on his own show the next day, I go over to the NYC and I say, interested in having me on? Yes. Right? So one day I was on WNYC. That's when I learned about bureaucracies, 80 employees, none of them working, none of them doing a thing, and yet we had a microphone that was so old it was the 1930s. You had to lean into the table, visualize this table, we had to lean into the table in order to make a statement. You're like, hello, are you there? You go into the room, they had those old like Frankenstein movie dials, you know. The
Right.
I said to the guy, when would these put in? When the station was built. But I see all those people out there. Yeah, they don't do any. Those are political jobs. How many? 82? Didn't do a thing each day, but they were paid. But those of us who were actually carrying on, no, we couldn't raise our voice, couldn't say anything, can't say anything. So I said, I spoke with the president of the network. I says, you mean that you don't have a budget for even the basics to upgrade the station, but all those people, the money goes to them? Yes. Speak up. You can't speak up. I said, I can't be on this station. That's when I went to WBAI. I gave my notice. But during that period of time, guess who calls me? Ellen Strauss. Gary, it was just a misunderstanding. You got to come back. No, I can't come back. What if we doubled your... No, you don't understand. You've shown yourself to be an angry, toxic, bitter, negative, evil person. I don't want to around you. I don't want to be in your energy field. I saw what you did to people. I saw how you used your power against people. I will never allow myself to be in the presence of people like you
right.
again.
Right.
I'd rather be unemployed.
Right.
That was it. Little story.
Excellent.
So you ask how people get ratings? By sharing positive energy on important issues with people who are now no longer programmed to believe that truth comes packaged. It comes as it is. And you're not getting it on the left and you're not getting it on the right.
I was on the McLaughlin Report. Sitting next to me was the editor of the New York Times. And I asked, simply said to him, I said, what business, what do you do? He looked at me kind of quizzically. He says, all the news that's fit to print. And I said, no, you're in the business of selling advertising space. You only put newspaper articles in there in order to cause people to buy the newspaper. Be honest.
Was that during the commercial break?
No, sir. Right on the air. Mr. Thompson, McLaughlin says.
That's why you haven't been back on there.
That's why.
Thank you. With our guests, let's go over now and say hello to Celia Farber and Michael Terry. Celia Farber is a journalist who covered the HIV wards extensively since 1987 in various publications, and some of these writings are collected in her book, Serious Adverse Events, an Uncensored History of AIDS, published by Melville House and now Random House. And activist Michael Callan called Farber the best AIDS journalist in the world. And she also has enemies, of course. Her 2006 article for Harper's Magazine detailed the totalitarian corruption of the HIV-AIDS research was titled Out of Control, AIDS and the Corruption of Medical Science. And by the way, she won the Samawise Clean Hands Award for Outstanding Investigative Journalism because of her work on that article. And we also have Terry Michael, who is for 20 years has been a news reporter and press secretary and former press spokesman for the Democratic National Committee. He's founder and director of the Washington Center for Politics and Journalism, where he teaches journalism students about politics. He is a gay man. He writes political commentary for Reason Magazine Online and at his libertarian democratic website, terrymichael.net. Nice to have you with us today, Terry, and also Celia.
Thank you, Gary.
Thank you, Gary.
Hey, Celia. How are you?
Hey, great.
I didn't know you were on.
I didn't know you were on.
Okay.
This is what makes it good radio. Terry, we're going to start with you. And I'm going to just ask you three questions and stay quiet and have you run with them, all right? As you know, in the past week, we've been inundated with headlines from all around the world about why we're not winning the war on AIDS. We just need more money. Desmond Tutu gave a whole idea that, you know, George Bush gave this amount of billions, $19 billion, but Obama, you haven't given enough. You've only given hundreds of millions. And if we just had more money, then we're sure that we will have more drugs that will do more good. And also, they want to test every human being. If we test every human being, we can immediately put them on drugs and save their lives. At the same time, with men, we can circumcise them. If we circumcise you, test you, and get you on drugs, sure not to get AIDS. Now, from your perspective, your research, what are the headlines telling us that we should be challenging? Where do you feel that we've gone wrong in our war on AIDS? And specifically, how gay males bought into the HIV equals AIDS dynamic, and the American AIDS Foundation and front groups, are they doing the work that they tell us they're doing? Are they really there to get people to believe that the answer lies within the drug paradigm?
And well, let me actually break in there, because I just came from lunch and I was reading the local gay newspaper here, and the American AIDS Healthcare Foundation has, for the last 6 weeks, had a full-page ad on the back page of the Washington Blade, the gay newspaper in Washington. On the front page last week was a press conference by the president of this health foundation, so-called health foundation. It's a Medicaid mill. It's an outrageous front group for the drug industry, and it really plays right into what you're asking about how gay men bought into this paradigm. The fact is that 30 years ago, gay males wanted to be off the hook. They wanted to say, well, there are no consequences to the lifestyle we've been living, spreading old pathogens, ingesting toxins in the form of recreational drugs, and we're a hated minority. That, of course, was what caused immune deficiency, and that's what caused immune systems to collapse. But gay males didn't want to hear that. So we got the single pathogen theory of AIDS, and we now have a drug industry that is fronted by this AIDS Healthcare Foundation and others who are bringing us to the point that we can no longer think straight about this subject, or think gay about this subject. I'm rambling here a little bit, but my gosh, I've lived through this for 25 or 30 years, and it just almost seems hopeless that we can break through this mindset that gay men somehow are comforted by the single pathogen theory of AIDS.
What happens to those gay males who, and or females as well, who decide to look deeper, find the connections between the pharmaceutical industry, the pro-HIV lobby efforts, the money trail, and then bring that public? What happens to those individuals within the gay community?
Oh, if you the bearer of evil tidings is always struck down, you are told that we're dancing on the graves of the dead, that we're not respecting the people who died from AIDS. Well, I think what really is disrespectful is not to acknowledge that it was not Bob Gallo's mysterious retrovirus that caused AIDS. It was, in fact, a multifactorial syndrome of causation syndrome. And trying to bring that news to gay men is really hard, because the drug companies are out there pumping away every day for more testing, for more treatment. Again, this AIDS Healthcare Foundation slime balls who are sort of parasites in this feeding on fear, as a matter of fact, that we've sown in the minds of gay men and now tens of millions of black Africans. I wish you could be more optimistic, but I'll tell you, every day I go through this, and I've been at it for 3.5 years now studying this, I just wonder, how we can break through. I'm trying my best because I have a background in politics, I have a background in journalism, mainstream, and I'm trying to insinuate some seeds of doubt, sow some seeds of doubt into both of those communities. I, like you, like Celia, we just keep plugging away and hoping that at some point a critical mass will be reached and we'll be able to break through this this wall of fear.
I have an idea. I want to share it with you in private. I'll call you later today, that I believe there is a way to break through. But I'll ask you that.
Okay.
I'll share that with you in private. Celia, over to you for this issue. Let's just look at the larger paradigm, the way the media in general and around the countries, where there's been, with the exception of those people who have chosen to look for the truth, the vast majority of media will carry whatever the AIDS story of the day is without any independent verification. Look at what it is to be a journalist. You're an award-winning journalist. You've been covering this story for over 25 years. You've seen what happens to journalists who stray from the official story, but go into the journalistic responsibilities that are not being adhered to so that we would have a different point of view.
Well, yeah. I have come to a point, Gary, after 24 years of covering this, where if somebody were to ask me what is the actual task of the American journalist in mainstream media, I would have to say that it's a total inversion of what I thought when I set out. And you spoke beautifully of my father earlier in the broadcast. I asked my father when I was just embarking on my great shining career in journalism, what was supposed to be. I was in my first year of journalism school at NYU. I later switched to a classics major because I was immediately bullied by my first journalism professor, actually over a Gary Null article that I cited in class. It was from Penthouse Magazine. So you and I go way back. Asked my father, what advice can you give me about journalism? I was basically entering the family business, you might say. And my father said, I can sum it up in three words: penetrate the ostensible. And I took that and ran with it. I was, 20 years old, 21 years old, and I thought, I got extremely excited. And that I was surrounded at the time by people. I was at Spin Magazine, Bob Guccione Jr., my first editor, Bob Keating. We all shared a belief that I now feel, it wasn't false, it was idealistic, it was lovely, but it was really a recipe for disaster in what would become the American media in the years to come. And our idea was that you find the story that nobody else has found. You penetrate it. You dig up the wires. You dig up the truth. You startle people. You try to, get at the aha reflex. And all of that is wrong. All of that, learned the hard way, you will be severely punished for all of those reflexes. And I was severely punished, and I regret nothing. I learned everything. I'm really sorry. There's a beep coming. That's just a call that's going into my voicemail. Just let that pass. So let me try to wind back to answer your question in a more direct way. Looking out over the landscape of American media today, and especially as it pertains to this totally Orwellian AIDS story, I think the American media is going down faster than faster than it thinks it is. I disagree somewhat with Terry about the sense of block and the sense of that we're not succeeding. From my point of view, it is the mainstream that is not succeeding. They are held up artificially by money, by advertising dollars, but they are not winning any hearts or minds. Would you agree with that, Gary, that in other words, there's different ways to measure success?
Let me give you one example. Last year, in fact, not just last year, about 7 months ago, there was a piece of legislation that had to that was making it mandatory that any doctor or nurse or anyone involved in the New York City healthcare system, New York State healthcare system, would have to take the H1N1 vaccine and the flu vaccine twice. So you're getting four vaccines, all of which, all of these contain mercury. In any case, they had everything on their side, including all the mainstream media, who were leading their fear attack. As Terry said, one of the reasons they win is because they promote fear within groups and communities. So in this case, it was if you're a doctor or nurse and you don't get this vaccine, then you could end up with, you know, serious illnesses. In any case, we went to work only using alternative media. And we had a big demonstration in Albany, all in just 2 days. Over 360,000 people contacted their legislators. We put out a major article, and we caused that piece of legislation to be killed. So I see that there's two tracks. One is the orthodox mainstream track, and the other is the alternative track. And the alternative track uses the Internet as its vehicle, and that Internet can dwarf, at least in response to people, at least winning hearts and minds. And we would later have 159,000 separate blogs, including some major blogs like Newsweek, carried the story. So that meant that everyone who read that was now at least raising concerns that there was another point of view. So I believe that we have a vehicle, the Internet. Let us use it, and let us not pretend that the mainstream media, whether it's the Times or Post or Daily News or Boston Globe or any of these, are ever going to be able to sit down with you, Terry, or you, Celia, Michael, or you, Celia, and look for your truths. They're not going to look for the truth.
They're not going to, and that's something I've recently made one big shift, and it was through grief and illness. It took a long time, but I finally have come out of it, and the shift was to shed my illusion, my, for me, very painful, life-stopping illusion that there was going to be this awakening in the media about the truth about AIDS. You know, if we just piled up enough corpses in front of them, could show them, but these people died, and they died from AZT, and here's Dr. XYZ even who will attest to it. Doesn't matter, doesn't matter, doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if Jesus Christ says it in person. And that is a really important, that's when I started to realize, okay, none of this is what I thought. And I'm the one who needs to change my sense of what the story is, my sense of the story of what the media was. I thought they were, you know, fearful and kind of conservative, and they just didn't get it. But if you could get them to read a few papers, they're nonsense. They it's like Manchurian candidates. They're programmed at such a subconscious level not to ask, not to open their eyes, and to succeed thereby, that they're going to roll on and go on in that kind of death juggernaut, I call it, and they will be successful in very toxic terms, and the other media will be very successful in terms of having a transparent and pure communication with a real audience. There will be a real communication. That's what I have now, having been totally knocked out of the media tree, which did cause me pain for many years. Now I feel totally free, and I can see that the absolute blessing in the whole process. And I'm very excited about this era to come in post-media. I call it post-media.
Well, good for you. That's very important, because I know how much pain and suffering you went through, and I know what contributions you made. And having gone through that whole mill, the difference was I have never in my life thought that the mainstream medical community, the mainstream media, the mainstream political community could ever be reformed or changed, and that's why I stopped trying to convince them of anything. I could really care less whether a mainstream doctor or a mainstream journalist cares about any of the truths I find. I'm looking for the person that is open to that truth. Let's go over to you. Michael, tell us your views about what you see your challenge to be and what you believe is the way to reach the people that you need to reach with the stories that you have.
Well, I think we have to do it incrementally. We have a mixed. We're in a mixed media culture. I try to do a little bit at a time here, using my credentials in politics and journalism, to reach out to friendly faces who I've known over the years, to try to get them to at least consider the argument of those of us who dissent from the HIV AIDS theory. I probably sounded too negative, too probably am more hopeful than I sounded at the beginning of this interview. But I, for example, am trying to inject myself into the mayoral campaign in Washington, D.C. right now. The mayor has announced back in January that he was going to test and treat a lot of black gay men and black heterosexual women in Washington, D.C. And I got a piece published in the Washington Times, the local conservative newspaper here, on that. And I think I probably made some headway. I think I probably stopped them from feeding the drugs to a lot of people. I'm almost certain I did. So sometimes I want to change the world, but you've got to do it one step at a time. So I just keep plugging away here.
Well, I think it's very important what you're doing, Michael, and I believe that I would like to see you have a forum. I would like to see Celia have a forum. I would like to see you both on radio with your own show on a weekly basis, talking about the issues that independent journalists need to share with people who are open enough in their mindset that they're not just going to be fed more propaganda. And I believe that more people are now realizing that both from the left and the right, they've been fed a lot of propaganda, whether it's on medical issues like AIDS or social issues or other issues. So I believe that is the next step that we have to look at.
Okay.
In that incremental area.
Well, I'm in it for the long haul, and I'm sure that, and Celia, even though she has gone back and forth in terms of whether she thinks there's any hope here to try to change the world here through journalism, I think there is. I teach young journalists. I think that we can, and I try every day when I teach these young journalists to open their minds on the subject. That's how I got into the whole dissent from HIV equals AIDS, was through a blog that I then shared with my journalism students. So I'm going to sound optimistic here at the end of this conversation.
Great.
Is there time for me to just jump in on something that Terry just said?
Yes.
There?
Go ahead, please. Yes.
Terry, when you say journalism, that's where we don't disagree that there's hope for journalism. What I mean to say is that journalism is morphing into it to contain and include what I'm calling post-media, right, which is an independent media, as Gary said, which is, I think it's quite obvious that is the direction that information gathering and absorption is going. People's relationship to information is now, there's no longer a pyramid structure where they receive it from an elite that they don't know, they can't see, they don't vaguely know that these people went to Ivy League schools, but they don't know why they should listen to them. No, it's lateral. People are going out now and foraging and getting their own information in accordance with their experience, what they already know, what they believe, and what they want to learn more about. And that's a massive shift toward a democratization of media. But
let me interrupt and say that I tell my students all the time that citizens, because of the Internet, are able to take over the political discourse right now. We're able to be content producers as well as content consumers. So I'm very optimistic that we can get, in the end, truth will prevail. That's the important thing.
It's just going to take a little bit of time.
You know, if you build it, they will come.
But when you say journalism, are you still thinking in terms of appointed
I'm thinking
sort
in terms
of guardians
of ethical standards? I'm thinking in terms of we want to be clear, fair, objective, factual, dispassionate. That is what is absolutely necessary if we're going to get people to respect the sources of real reporting. A lot of good reporting is going on at the New York Times, at the Washington Post. A lot of terrible reporting goes on at the New York Times, at the Washington, and the Washington Post. But truth finds its way. Truth will eventually out itself. So I'm going to end this with a very optimistic note about the future of what I consider responsible journalism in America.
Well, good. Well, thank you both very much, Celia Farber, Michael Terry. I look forward to carrying on.
To clarify for you, Gary, I have a confusing name. It's Terry Michael.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Terry, the last name is Michael.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry, Terry.
Everyone makes that mistake. My mother made it.
I don't know anyone who has two first names.
Yep.
All right, Terry, thank you. Terry Michael and Celia Farber. And it's terrymichael.wcpj is SkyCap. And I don't know about the and the internet is what?
As a matter of fact, to find my writing on, which is what I would prefer people to do, to read my writing on
yes.
HIV and AIDS, is terrymichael.net.
Terrymichael.net.
www.terrymichael.net. I think I express myself in essay form better than I do on radio.
Thank you very much. I look forward. I'll talk to you a little later today if you have time.
Okay.
Celia Farber. Celia, first of all, people should be aware of the book called Serious Adverse Events, An Uncensored History of AIDS, published by Melville House and now Random House. Do you have a website for people to go to?
I do. Thank you for asking. It's called The Truth Barrier, thetruthbarrier.com.
Thetruthbarrier.com. Thank you very much, Celia.
Thank you, Gary.
We're out of time. I want to apologize for being a little over for our next show here, Jim Turner of Consuming Interest. I look forward to sharing more with you, including a lot of information on how to have a perfect relationship on my Sunday night show. I'm going to deal with that. I didn't have time today at 8 o'clock right here on the Progressive Radio Network. Have a nice day, everyone.
The Gary Knoll Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Carol Lee. I was born with the cure.